I'd like to call to order today's hearing, House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance, today, February 24, 2011. And would the committee clerk take the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Vice Chair Szymanski?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Anderson?
Here.
Representative Champion? Representative Greenhagen?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Creasel?
Here.
Lane is excused. Lesh is excused. Representative Leland?
Here.
Representative Mazerol?
Here.
Representative Baleen?
Here.
Representative Schumacher?
Here.
Representative Vogel?
Here.
Representative Wardlow?
Here.
Well, the chair notes that we do have a quorum. Before we go to the agenda, welcome Representative Maylene.
Thank you.
And when we started our trek down the path of judiciary policy and finance last month, we each had an opportunity to spout off, tell about ourselves. So you have a couple minutes. Go right ahead. Introduce yourself to us.
Sure. My name is Carly Maylene, and this is my second official day on the job. I'm from Hibbing. And I was elected in a special election on February 15th to replace Commissioner Sertich. So this is his former seat, and I was sworn in just a couple days ago. So like I said, this is my second day on the job. I am an attorney. I went to Hamline Law School. I was able to return to the Iron Range after finishing law school and taking the bar exam, and I got employment up there. I was working for the state, and then this opportunity opened, so I ran for office, and here I am. I'm really excited to be on this committee, and I look forward to all the work that we're going to be doing over this session.
Very good. I'd like the committee staff, I'll put you all on the spot to introduce yourself, starting with our CLA.
I'm Erin Eden. I also go to Hamline.
I'm Jody Withers. I'm the committee administrator.
I'm Becky Perius, nonpartisan House Research.
I'm Emily Adrians, nonpartisan House Fiscal Staff.
I'm Dennis Merton, Republican Research.
And Drew Smith, DFL Research.
Very good. Let's get on with our business. We do have minutes in the folder from the meeting on February 22. Is there a motion to approve those minutes?
I'll move, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Motion's been made to approve the minutes for February 22, 2011. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails, and the minutes of February 22 are approved. Members, we have two line items we're going to go to. First, Judicial Standards Board, and then the Tax Court. I'll just give you a quick reminder that the responses we received in advance from these agencies before us today are included in your folders. Judicial Standards Board, Mr. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the governor has recommended for the coming biennium, that the Judicial Standards Board appropriated a total of $456,000 for the two-year period. This is basically the same amount that the board had in prior to the 2011 period. 2011, our regular appropriation was reduced by $14,000. And in this setting, we asked the governor to recommend not only our base budget, but that the $14,000 be restored. This was in the context of a $290,000 deficiency, which we have due to a very unusual situation, that being five public hearings, one of which was settled recently. But there are still four more public proceedings currently pending, two of which are right now in the panel stage, that is the the trial fact-finding recommendation stage. In those cases, the fact-finding periods have been exhausted. The trials, basically, they're like little trials, have been held and conducted. And both of those cases are in the hands of the panel, which is a three-member panel, one of which is usually a retired judge, one of which is usually a former member of the board, and one of which is usually a lawyer who has some experience in ethical matters. That's two cases. The other two cases that are still pending are set for trial. One is set in April, and one is set in June. The impact to our normal budget, in aside from the deficiency, is that most of these costs for the hearing have to come out of our normal budget, and we have a certain amount set aside for that, and that is, we have $125,000in the normal revolving fund that we have, and this is what pays for the court reporters, what pays for the rooms, what pays for the various other costs, including, but also some investigation costs. Basically, our budget is divided into two halves, two parts. The first is the regular operating part, and the second is the revolving part that is dedicated strictly to attorney's fees, court costs, investigations. This is $125,000 per annum, and it revolves. In other words, it goes, if we don't use it all, which not the case lately, but if we don't use it all, it goes into the next year, and then for the next budget period, whatever is the total amount of $250,000, that amount is subtracted to the amount that's already in there, and then it goes back up to $250,000 for the next 2 years. We feel strongly that this is a rare occurrence. It is the first time in my tenure that we have had this many hearings pending over a period. We usually have one, maybe two. I can't remember a time when we had two, but we usually have one pending. And this year, as I said, we started out with five and one settled, so we now have four. We don't think this is going to be a continuous thing, but we are not by any means in control of who asks for hearing. When the board decides that discipline is appropriate, some type of public discipline is appropriate, which it does two or three times a year, sometimes four times a year, judges and judicial officers have the absolute constitutional right to contest this. It's a question of due process. The hearings are required by statute. Once the judge or the judicial officer asks for it, we have no choice but to grant it. And between the statutes, the rules, and the Constitution, this is not something that we can control. We only do one thing. We don't have a number of different programs. All we do is judicial discipline. And it just happens this year that we need the extra money. We've asked the governor for it, and he has recommended it. And I'm here to take any questions that you may have.
Mr. Paul, I'll start off the questioning with a few of mine. Does your office, Mr. Paul, perform any functions that are not required by statute?
We do not. I don't think that our advisory and educational functions are required by statute, but it's actually the main reason we exist, is to educate people about what types of powers we have, where they should go if something that they propose to us is not within our power, and also to advise judges who call regularly 20 to 25 times per month. That is the main action, and processing complaints is the main activity of the board. This is the public aspect, the public hearing aspect is not a majority type of thing, required by statute or constitution, but it is the main reason for us to exist. The public hearing duties are all required by either constitution, statute, or court rule.
the education functions that you perform that you referred to as being not required by statute, what portion of your time do you estimate that requires?
Mr. Chairman, I would estimate that at about 60%.
What form or forms does that education function take?
Mr. Chairman, typically, let's just take the public aspect first. A member of the public will call and will ask, will describe a scenario to me, a fact situation to me. And at that point, I advise them as to whether or not, as to what we do. In other words, make the distinction between judges acting in their decisional capacity and in their private capacity. And I try to apply those distinctions to the fact situation that I've heard. If it's something that is not required for us to go forward on, then I try to steer them into another area, perhaps to go back to the court, try to get a lawyer. Sometimes I, if the money is an issue with the lawyer, which it sometimes is, I try to refer them to various agencies that might help them. In other words, the education part is the distinguishing between the types of things over which the board has control, the private conduct, the personal conduct, should I say, and the matters over which the board does not have control, which is the issues which commonly come before a court. And on the judicial side, judges call me judges, judicial officers, conciliation court people, all the people who are under the board's jurisdiction, call and ask scenario questions. Can I write a letter of recommendation for my law clerk? I've been invited to speak at such and such an organization. Would that be appropriate? These are the types of things that I get quite commonly.
The 60% education function, is it limited solely to telephone question and answers, or do you print material and disseminate it? Do you have seminars?
Included.
What goes into the 60%?
Mr. Chairman, included in this would be letters that I write to both judges and the public, advisories that I propose to the board and that they approve. Sometimes the judges want advice in writing for several good reasons, and we do that 3, 4, 5 times a year, as these all are reported in our annual report. All of these are, they're not in there by name of the judge, but they're in there just in terms of just reference to what they hold. So it involves quite a bit of research, quite a bit of writing. It is more than just phone calls. Sometimes, you know, the same person can call and then write a letter also. Sometimes it's not perfectly clear to me often it's not clear to me exactly what is happening at the trial level. And so I just try to encourage people to write down what they are questioning about. And then once it's in writing, it usually becomes a lot clearer. So sometimes I have to do both for the same, turns out to be for the same person. I would also include in that the going out, what you might term as the outreach aspect of the board, coming out and making presentations to judges, to members of the public, to lawyers. These things are done commonly throughout the year and would be part of that function.
Mr. Paul, I have a few more questions. In addition to acting on complaints that you receive, does the board ever initiate an inquiry on its own authority, and if so, how often?
The board is authorized to initiate an inquiry on its own, and it does not take place very often. I would estimate under 5 times per year, and out of those 5, I would estimate that 1 or 2 of those the board goes forward with. Also, the board is authorized to pursue complaints that where the complaining person is not disclosed, for sometimes because retaliation may be feared, either perceived or either real or not real, but it really doesn't make any difference. And that would also fit into that category. The board basically, according to the rules, may make a complaint on its own motion from any source. So a newspaper article, a anonymous tip, that type of thing.
Mr. Paul, in the biennial budget booklet that we have, it references the deficiency request of $290,000. And in one of the pieces of information here, it says that the most recent previous disciplinary matter cost $186,272 to completion. Are you familiar with that particular case? It's on page 7 of the Judicial Standards Board section.
Yes, I am.
Obviously, and of course, without divulging any names, but can you describe from beginning to end that disciplinary matter, how it got started and how it ended? And I guess I'm going to want to know why $186,000 in fees were required for one particular case. So if you could describe from beginning to end that particular matter.
Yes, well, that particular matter came in as a complaint, and it was a huge complaint. It was probably an inch thick. It had a number of allegations in it. The board, I, on behalf of the board, evaluated those allegations, investigated those allegations, tried to pare them down. And in about halfway through that process, it was a much more serious allegation, the allegation that ultimately went to hearing and went to the Supreme Court, was disclosed. This was the allegation that the judge had received a discount of some 60% on his divorce bill, while at the same time referring to arbitration family law cases to the law firm that represented him. At that point, it became a full-fledged investigation. There's a lot to it. There's going through all of the records and interviewing the law firms and going through all those records. And the judge requested a hearing. The hearing took almost 3 days. You can, as a lawyer yourself, you know that there is one heck of a lot of preparation goes into a three-day hearing. It's weeks and weeks. Thereafter, the case was appealed to the Supreme Court, and briefs were filed both to the panel and to the Supreme Court. This is a laborious process, and the whole thing took maybe 2 years to complete. But it is, what it turns out to be, is a standard legal case. Even though it's not really a violation of any law, usually, but it's just a violation of ethics rules. But the procedures involved are similar to a standard legal case. And, you know, wheels of justice grind a little bit slow, and they are expensive to move. And
this particular case at $186,000, was there one outside attorney hired, or were there more than one on that case?
There was one law firm.
What was the hourly rate charged by that attorney?
The hourly rate charged was $250 per hour, which at that point was something like less than half of what the law firm charges other clients.
Do you have a retainer agreement, that written retainer agreement that you sign with outside counsel when you hire one up?
I do, yes.
Is it a standard form that you use in each case?
Yes, it is.
Will you supply this committee with a blank copy of one of those retainer agreements?
I'd be happy to.
contained in that retainer agreement, do you have the authority by the agreement as a board to review the billing statement submitted by the attorney?
Yes, indeed.
And do you have the authority under your retainer agreement to dispute and or discount particular line item charges?
Yes.
Does the charging in this particular case and or in any other case, do the attorneys use a unit billing system to bill the board? Or is actual hard time charged out?
Yes.
Yes, which?
It's the hard time bill.
All right.
It's the actual time.
In this particular case, did you review the charges and did you discount any of the charges, or was the $186K the entire bill?
I don't recall reducing any of the line charges. I do recall reviewing all of them.
Do you recall any billings received by the board that you've reviewed and actually discounted or removed some of the charges?
On occasion, yes. In the past.
One closing question. Is there any way that you can think of that you could, on a different matter here, that you could leverage existing technology to improve your efficiencies?
We've actually been through that process a great deal over the last 3 to 4 years. There is one thing I would like to do is I would like to put our closed cases on a automatic notifying system. The rules require us to destroy files that are 3 years old when there's no active cases over the period. I would like to see an automatic system come up so that we could review those cases more often than we do. We're working on that, but at this point it would not be possible for us to do that because of the other demands on our budget, but perhaps someday that might work. I have a very efficient computer system. We run the office, just the two of us. Myself, I run the complaint side, and my assistant runs the actual state side of it, and we have a pretty complete system. We're able to keep track of it nicely.
We do have other representatives that want to question, but I want to get back to that particular billing that we just discussed. Did I hear you correctly? Did you say that the $250 per hour was half the rate charged by that attorney for all other clients?
I believe it would be less than half. My understanding was that the attorney involved charges $600 an hour. And I might point out that I've never signed an agreement that is in excess of $250 per hour, and every attorney that I ever hired charges more than double that, usually. So either double that or more than double that.
Okay, we have Representatives Johnson, Hillstrom, and then Champion. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a broad question. Does the Board of Judicial Standards, does that exist in every state? Is this anything unique? Can you give me a little context on that?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Paul.
I believe that the Board on Judicial Standards does exist in some form in every state. Many of them are called commissions. Some of them are, they're usually called commissions or boards, but I think they exist in every state, yes.
Representative Johnson.
And looking at your written testimony, you state that a 15 or 20% reduction would eliminate the agency. Is that a pretty, you want to say a little bit more about that? Is that a pretty firm conclusion on your part?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, it's hard to predict what a 15 or 20% reduction would do, but we run on the edge all the time. Especially in the last few years when we've had these hearings, these costs, as I say, come out of our main budget. And so it is difficult to it would be difficult to operate the agency without the components of the budget.
And then one last question, then, Mr. Chair. So if your agency went out of business, who would perform the service that appears to be necessary?
Mr. Paul.
There is no agency in the state of Minnesota that does what we do. We are an independent agency, and there's nobody who could do it. Also, Representative Johnson, I think it's important to understand that complaining about judges or judicial officers is a difficult thing for members of the public, lawyers, even other judges to do. It's a very, very difficult thing for them to do. And I think that if there was no independent agency that could keep their complaints confidential, that could work in private at first, at least, to resolve these cases. And, of course, one of our basic tenets is that there can be no retaliation. Again, it is very rare for any judge to retaliate. It does happen. But it's not the numbers of instances of retaliation that counts with the public and with lawyers. It's the appearance. It's the fear of retaliation. And without an agency like that, I think that it would be very difficult for anybody to complain. And you know, there's probably 400 district court judges and referees in the state. There's probably another 200 magistrates and part-time conciliation court judges and child support magistrates. There is, most of them have no difficulty ever with the board, but even a small percentage can keep an agency, a two-person agency like ours, really hopping. And that is what happens as a general rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two sets of subject questions, and so I'd like to first take us back to the lawyers that are chosen for investigations. Can you tell me how you determine what attorneys you're going to use for an investigation? Do you do RFPs, requests for proposals? Do you just go out and pick whoever you'd like? How do you pick those?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, we select our attorneys from a group of three. We tell them that we cannot pay over $250 per hour. We tell them that if we run out of money, they might have to wait for their money. We get recommendations from members of our board and from other judges, other lawyers, members of the public as to who is good and who might be well suited to our type of work in this particular case. And the board usually makes a selection from the three that it gets. There are cases in which we have chosen the same attorney repeatedly. We find that it is difficult for an attorney to come into a case fresh. We've got a very complex and taxing set of rules. It takes a long time to get to know these rules and to work with them appropriately. And there's a kind of a training period. And if we choose the same attorneys over and over, we find that it's cheaper for us in the long run to do that.
Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you collect names and suggestions from people in the field, and then you get a list of three. So who decides who should be those three, and then who decides who gets picked from the group of three?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, the resumes and the information goes to the board, and they narrow it down to three, and then they do the selection.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then how did the board decide on $250, and how long has it been $250, and is that the going rate in the market? There's a lot of lawyers out of work. I don't know too many folks making $600 an hour or even $250 an hour. So how is $250 arrived at, and do you think that's still the right number based on the market?
Mr. Paul.
Yes, I do. That is a maximum that we pay. We have one lawyer who's excellent, who's working right now at $210 an hour. We need the best lawyers. Actions against judicial officers and judges are very, very difficult. And we are obligated by our rules to prove up our cases by clear and convincing evidence, which is a very high legal standard. We need the best lawyers we can get, and we do get them. And it's a big sacrifice for these lawyers to serve the board, as I said, because they, when we run out of money, then it's just nothing happens. It's just we have to wait until we get more, and they agree to do that. And the best lawyers do cost a lot of money, but we need them badly because these cases are very, very hotly contested. You may have read in the newspaper recently about a couple of these cases which occurred this year in January. And they are very, very highly contested, and we don't want to have any difficulties in presenting the best case that we can, making sure all the facts that we have developed come out and that they get into evidence.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what was the total amount in legal fees that you paid last year?
Mr. Paul.
Well, what we paid up to the extent that we had money, which was $125,000.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how many lawyers then were on staff throughout the year? Is it something that one lawyer could do at $125,000 a year, and you could bring them on and train them and make them experts, or does that go up or down each year?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman. You know, we've considered that, but it would not, first of all, you could not employ an extra person for $125,000. You would have to pay that person. There's the benefits. We have no room in our office for another person. But more than that, it could be a two-year period where we had no hearings, and that person would have nothing to do. So that would not be a wise way, we don't think, to spend the money. When we have it, we go with it. When we don't have it, then we don't have to spend it. And it would be, I think it would be an inopportune expense to have that kind of constant expense. In 2 years, we could have no hearings, and then we would have to go through all that for nothing. And actually, you know, it's when we have no hearings, that's usually the better way to go. It just means that the discipline is going out and not being challenged.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to take us in a different direction slightly now, but you'll allow me. It's my understanding that recently the board has been doing some things with some retired judges. Can you tell me, if a judge is retired and they no longer have their license, what consequence can they get at the end of an investigation?
Mr. Paul.
This is, Representative, this is a new rule that we are obligated to enforce now. The old rule was that when a judge resigned from his or her office, that was the end of it. We had no further jurisdiction. I fought to continue that rule, by the way, when we were having our rules reexamined. But the committee felt strongly this what was happening was that judges would get in trouble, and then they would go to the governor and ask for a disability, or they would retire. And as soon as they retired, of course, everything would have to stop. And it was the feeling of the committee that the public was not served when a judge was able to stop a board action in this way, especially when the governor was often did not have an opportunity to know what we knew, what the board knew. And sometimes the governor would grant a disability on lack of the, without having the best information and without knowing that there was a proceeding even going on. And so the committee, for in its wisdom, decided that when a judge acts in his or her judicial capacity, that misconduct is alleged, that misconduct action can go beyond the retirement date. And you ask also what can happen to a judge. You know, the same thing can happen, and I don't know, there has not been a case before the Supreme Court yet, although one or two of the cases that are currently pending do involve, I think one of the cases currently pending do involve a retired judge. We don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do, but in theory, all of the discipline elements that are available to it now would be available to it for a retired judge. Many of these retired judges, you know, become senior judges and preside over cases, although they are past the retirement age under the Supreme Court's order. And those cases are now under our jurisdiction, and the committee felt and the Supreme Court agreed that it was that we should pursue those cases, so we do. We were not in control of that decision.
Representative Hillstrom.
I think he cleared up all of my questions surrounding that issue, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Park, a couple questions. It's my understanding that the Board of Judicial Standards is a legislatively created body, and the Constitution provides that the legislature may provide for removal and discipline of judges. Can you tell me what oversight has been provided by the legislature in guiding the board around discipline of judges and or removal of a judge?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion. Yes, the being an independent agency, the oversight is in three stages. The legislature, of course, has the financial oversight. The Supreme Court has the rule-making authority at which it performs, and the executive branch appoints the members to the board. So you can see that all three branches are involved in overseeing the board.
Anything else?
Yes,
Mr. Chair. Chappie, go ahead.
If I may, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, so it appears, and I just don't want to put words in your mouth, but from the composition and how the board comes together, you believe that that is the extent of the oversight provided by the legislature?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion, yes, I think that's the extent of it. Of course, the legislature retains its power to impeach any judge that is independent of our agency. So that's probably an additional check on judges.
Mr. Chair, a couple more questions.
Representative Champion.
Based on your line of thinking and your line of testimony, as we look at the notion of impeachment, in order for the legislature to utilize its power to impeach, wouldn't you agree that we would have to have some notification and some information around the conduct of judges?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion, yes. Yes, I think the legislature would act only on some kind of information. For example, the legislature could observe our proceedings and act on that, or ultimately it would be the Supreme Court proceedings. The legislature could act on an independent item of information. If your question is, I don't think your question is exactly whether or not you need some reason to move, but I think you understand that. But I think that your question reaches into the type of information that the legislature could act on. And I think, like the board, the legislature could act on information from any source.
Representative Champion.
Thank you. And Mr. Paul, based on your testimony, what particular body, as you know it, even though we're talking about the legislature, what committee would this information come to in order for this particular body to act on the conduct of judges?
Mr. Paul.
Representative Smith and Representative Champion. You know, I'm probably not up on my impeachment like I should be, but I think the Senate probably charges these matters out. Maybe it's the House that charges the matters out and the Senate that tries them. I'm really not sure what the process is, but it's well laid out in the law. I'm sorry that I cannot recall it at this point.
Just two last questions.
Go right ahead, Representative Champion.
Thank you. Do you believe the composition of the board as it sits right now affects your ability to get a clear sense of the board's thoughts about a particular action that is brought before the body?
Representative Paul.
Representative Champion, the composition of the board, you mean the four-judge, four members of the public, two-lawyer composition?
Mr. Chair. The number, like, is my understanding, it's a total of 10 members that's on the Board of Judicial Standards. And I think from your previous testimony, you indicated that if there's a clear split, 5-4, an investigation happened, 5 against an investigation happened, that the act fails and there's nothing that's done. And so my question is more to whether you believe the number of members on the board affects the board's ability to clearly indicate what the board's thoughts are or what actions should be taken.
Mr. Paul.
Representative Champion, I understand what you're saying. You're saying that if it was split 5-5, there would be no action, and that is true. However, from a practical standpoint, first of all, to answer your question, I do believe that the current composition of the board allows the clear will of the board to be executed, and certainly allows me to understand what their instructions are. You know, in 11 years, I never saw a 5-5 vote. I occasionally see a 10-1 and a 9-1 or an 8-2 vote. I never see a 5-5 vote. I don't think that type of, it is of course conceivable that there would be an issue on which the board might divide itself 5-5. I don't think from a practical standpoint that is an issue that would need immediate attention.
One last question,
Representative
Mr. Chair.
Champion.
Mr. Paul, I believe it was from your previous testimony that you indicated that there's roughly 1,600 contacts that the Board of Judicial Standards received. And out of the 1,600 contacts, there are roughly 115 to 123 of those contacts result in a decision being made by the board to do more of an investigation of those matters. In addition to that, I heard you say today that 60% of the board's time or expense revolves around education. Is that right? And if that's right, can you tell me why you think that this particular body should continue the funding without a reduction to your group, especially if they're doing something outside of their particular mandate, which is to investigate and make the public aware of conduct of judges?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, you have to let me know if I'm not answering your question, but if you reduce what the governor has proposed in the context of our deficiency, it would be a difficult thing because we are already overspending on issues that are constitutionally and statutorily required and on issues which I do not think will necessarily repeat itself. In other words, I don't think another deficiency will be required, maybe one more deficiency, but on these cases, once these cases are gone, I don't think that we will be placed in this situation again for many years. But you can see that if we have a certain amount of money in our regular budget, this is a apart from the $125,000 revolving fund. For example, the court reporting fees this year, Representative Champion, are way beyond anything we've experienced, at least I've experienced in the 11 years. I think the board had one or two other periods in the past. But you can see that reducing the amount available to the board would just increase our deficiency if given the constitutional and statutory duties that we have and the duties that are imposed on us by the Supreme Court rule.
Really, one last question. I just want to know, what was the result of the $186,000 case?
Representative Champion, Mr. Paul.
Well, I believe that the, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Representative Champion, I believe that the judge involved was found to have committed misconduct and was suspended without pay for a period of 6 months. And thereafter, at the next election, this judge was not reelected.
Mr. Paul, there are no other questions. However, maybe two. When was the board created? What year?
Mr. Chairman, the board was created in 1974 after the constitutional amendment taking care of the balance of powers was passed.
I know that the 4th Judicial District, Hennepin County, pays some funds to store records. Does the board store all of its records from that year?
Mr. Chairman, we have a group of records which are stored, and these are the records which on which there has been public discipline which can never be destroyed, or private discipline which can never be destroyed. There's a distinction to be made between these records and records of judges who have had a period of complaint inactivity, which those records are destroyed. So as to those records which are preserved, yes, we have made an investment. We have not completed it yet, and we have, for that reason, we have not been charged for it yet, but we have made arrangements for some of these records, and many of them are not on there yet, to be stored in, and you're going to have to forgive me because I don't know exactly how to describe this, but stored in some electronic spot where they are completely confidential and totally protected in terms of security. We have a few of the records in there. And we are trying to put them in as we go. It's taking a while now to put the past records in there.
So you're converting hard copy paper records to electronic storage?
We are experimenting with that, yes.
And then what do you do with the hard copy? Destroy that, shred it?
Well, as yet, we have not destroyed those hard copies because we want to see how it works. But eventually, even if we did not destroy any of the hard copies we had and we kept them, which they take up about maybe 30 square feet, we have this filing system that is double-sided and it's very efficient. Even if we didn't ever destroy those records, it might be helpful for us to put all future records, you know, it might save us some storage space in the future, is our thought. And also, of course, there are certain other reasons why you might want to do that. For example, protection against fire, this type of thing.
All right, if there's no other questions, I want to thank you for coming today. And you're dismissed.
Thank you very much.
And now we'll go to the tax court, and I'd ask Chief Judge George Perez to come to the table, identify himself, and then proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
My name is George Perez, and this is Lisa Feister, our court administrator.
Good morning.
I'll cover three basic areas. I know I've testified before recently this committee, and we talked more about the substance of what the tax court does, and there were several questions, and I'm, of course, happy to answer all those questions in addition to all budgetary questions. I'll start off by saying that the tax court is a non-criminal court. In other words, if there's a criminal proceeding, if an individual doesn't pay their taxes, they do not proceed into tax court. Tax court is really the people's court. If you are looking for a tax refund, tax relief, tax remedies, that's where you go. You don't go into district court. You don't go into bankruptcy court. You go to tax court. If you're contesting your property tax appeals, income tax, sales and use tax, this is where you end up in tax court, and you seek relief through the tax process. I wanted to cover three areas briefly. One is the biennium budget year, including the fiscal 2011 year, then go into more of a line-by-line item of the tax court's expenditures, and then lastly, I wanted to cover the case filings and how they generate revenue that more than covers what the tax court budget is. And I know that those materials have been provided to this committee. But if anyone needs copies, I think we might have a couple extra copies. First, to the budget, the biennial budget, which is the 2012-2013, and I would also tie in the 2011, which is, excuse me, this current year. There was a deficiency request that was made and granted by the governor's office in the amount of $38,000 to cover a deficiency for the fiscal 2011. And that deficiency allows the court, the tax court, to remain open. Otherwise, it would shut down for about 6 weeks or so if that deficiency is not provided. And I think along those lines, for fiscal 2012 and 2013, there has been appropriations made by the governor's office of $35,000 for each year, respectively. And again, that goes to the heart of covering the tax court's doors remaining open. The reason for that amount being different in the prior biennium is that the court experienced a cut by the previous biennium, and as a result of that, the court did close its doors last year for 2 weeks. Obviously, the cut was deeper and would require a greater length of time for closure if that deficiency is not met. And so that's the reason why the deficiency was requested in the first place, and B, why there's the appropriations of $35,000 going into each fiscal year moving forward into the biennium of 2012 and 2013. I know that we provided, as part of the information requested by this committee, a tax court budget information for FY 2011, and that was just to go through sort of a line by line. Our costs are divided approximately into three areas, if you think of a pie chart: payroll, rent, and supplies, operating expenses. We have, and maybe because we deal in numbers in the tax court, we look at every line item, we look at every nickel and how it's spent and how it's and how it's expensed. And when we have gone through each line item, I mean, we look at payroll. We have six people full time, three judges, three staff. We look at rent. We disputed over the last couple of years. There's been a rent increase, and that was a result primarily of the. It was a result of recalculation by the Office of Administration, which handles the rental aspects, and they recalculated square footage. We didn't increase square footage. We didn't lose square footage. They just simply recalculated common spaces and other areas and allocated a greater sum. And that was some of what contributed also to our deficiency, was that in the middle of the last biennium, there was an increase, and it was too late for us to request an increase. While we did request one, it was already in the middle of the biennium process at that point. When we look at our other expenses, such as technology, $4,765, that's broken down into maintaining our current software, which is a software that operates and handles all the court cases. Lisa is the one who primarily works in that area, although our other two staff also work in that area. But that's how we organize all the cases that come in. That's how we administrate and process all the cases that come in. And that is a fee that's paid for maintaining, upkeep. A small portion of that, roughly about, we cap it at, I think, $1,500. That's for breakdowns, which all of us experience through using equipment. Breakdowns, if they have to add a new virus, if our security virus has been breached, which has happened from time to time. Again, all this information is confidential, and so we have to maintain that firewall best as possible. And so that's why we, from time to time, we'll experience a breach, and we have to have people come in and repair that. With communications, our expenditures of postage and phones and the router system, which is our internet access service, $1,900, our phones, $5,000. We remain one of the few agencies that that does answer the phone. We've looked into going automated. We don't know that the trade-off would be a financial gain. We'd have to first convert and get a whole new phone system, so that would incur an expense. We still do handle phone calls and rather than put people through a matrix system. Postage is an interesting area. It's $5,000, and I know as we move into a technology, and I see that coming where we e-file everything, that is an area that could decrease. In some ways, it could also be a wash, because the more we email out, we lose that expense and we gain there. However, then emails come in and we have to still print out, so then our costs would go up in printing. One of the things that I thought of doing and we're experimenting with is sending emails out when we need to, but requesting parties to provide hard copies so that we don't incur that expense. Because when we get volumes of briefs, we'd have to print those out, and then our expense would go up. So at this point, we're still requesting parties to provide those hard copies so that we don't lose that savings that we can gain as we, state of Minnesota, the court systems, move into a more e-filing system. The other area is court reporters by statute. Excuse me. Fighting a minor cold here. The court reporter, by statute, we are required to schedule and provide the court reporter's service, but by statute, the taxpayer is required to make that payment. There, you may see that there is a $720 expense there, and that happens when we have pro ses that simply disappear after trial. They disappear. We can't get a hold of them. The court reporting services can't get a hold of them. It goes into collections and other forms. At times, we end up paying covering that, because if we do not cover that, we could not get a court reporter service to cover our cases. And by statute, we're required to provide court reporter services. The one thing that I have thought of doing, and we're experimenting with this as well, most of our problems with non-payment occur with pro se litigants, those that are not represented. One of the things that we are experimenting with doing is recording those hearings so that they are recorded under the statute, and if a transcript is then ordered, then that recording can be sent to the particular court reporter services. And if it's not, then there's no other expense incurred, and the court wouldn't have to incur that expense. We did renegotiate our copier contract. It was at $5,000. We got it. It was over $5,000. We renegotiated to under $5,000, and just pleaded with them that our expenses are so limited and our resources are so limited, and we got a better contract going forward as of fiscal 2011. So I think to conclude this area, we have looked at every item, and we have looked at places where we can save, and we've attempted to do those. I will inform the committee something that I didn't discuss last time is we have pro se litigants. Those are litigants that are not represented. While they are not the majority, they are a growing number. They do take up a lot of court resources. They do take up a lot of judge time. One of the things that I have embarked in is a program with the local bar, the local tax bar, in which they've created, are creating a pro bono program so that they can service these individuals. We can refer the names after they file their cases with us, refer the names to this program where they would then assist them for free of charge. And that would be a great burden that they would reduce the court's time. It could almost half our time by having those individuals talk to pro se litigants, whether it's an hour, 5 hours, or even assist them through an actual case that goes through fruition. So that's a project that is getting off the ground and will get off the ground this year. The second point is another savings that we've maintained is that we're the only court in the state of Minnesota that does not employ full-time law clerks. And I know for many of you who are attorneys, you understand that law clerks are a necessity for judges to look up cases, to look up things. We have done that primarily in ourselves. I did create a program where we tap the local law schools. It's not a perfect program, but it is a program in which we take law students and we take them for 3 months at a time. That's the only program that they have available. And so they are partial assistance, and it's a partial help. But it's another way of keeping costs down and staying with the original six employees that we've had since the inception of the tax court to the present date. I guess I would just conclude before taking Lisa pointed out that one of the other things that we're also doing is by statute we're required to travel to all 87 counties. We used to have a budget of about 2,000. We self-cut that budget to about 500. Wherever possible, we do telephonic calls, and we do it in such a way so that we don't compromise the integrity of the actual hearing itself. If it needs to be in person, we'll do it in person. But if it's something that we can do telephonically, then we will do telephonically. There's also ITV, which has gotten better over the years since I have used it and experienced it. It's not a perfect system. It still requires some expense that we're required to pay when we order ITV, but that keeps everybody in their respective jurisdictions, and they go to their local courthouse, and we go to our court, and we conduct the hearing that way, and we've managed to take care of a few hearings that way without incurring the expense of going outstate and staying 2 or 3 days to hear the case, incur hotel expenses, travel expenses, and so forth. So wherever we can do that, we've done it. We've been able to self-cut that budget. And again, I don't think we can do it 100% of the time because we don't want to jeopardize or threaten the integrity of the actual process where it needs to be in person. For whatever reason, if technology is just not adequate enough, then we do have to do it in person. And that's why we still have about $500 itemized for that expense. I think lastly, before taking questions, I'd like to conclude. I did provide a sheet that I sent in just recently to your assistant, and that is what the number of filings that we have. If you multiply that by the number of by the cost of the filing fees, which is set by this legislature, I grafted it out. 2009, that total amount is $1.4 million. In 2010, last year, that amount rose to $1.7 million. And if we project just even a slight increase in what our cases are, and our case filings are steadily going up, that would project out to over $2 million. And again, our budget annually is in what we are being appropriated by the governor's office, and what we are asking for is the $825,000. So that what we bring in more than covers that amount. It does go into the general fund, as we've discussed earlier. It does not come to the court. But that just to give an idea of the revenue that is generated through the filing fees with the court. I think I would conclude by answering a question that was asked by Representative Holstrom. And I know that she has stepped out for the moment, but I would still answer that. And she asked what the breakdown was in filings between the residential filings, homes and so forth, residences, versus commercial. And we did an informal check, and it came out to about 40% residential, 60% commercial. And that roughly is what occurs from year to year. Some minor changes, but roughly that's what we experience from year to year. And with that, I'll conclude my comments and take questions.
Judge Perez, I'll start the questioning, if you will. And I think I'll touch on the last, second to the last item you talked about, and that is the reference in statute, Minnesota Statute 271.04, discussing your hearings and venue, and the court is shall hold hearings according to the statute as may be prescribed by your rules of the tax court. Principal office shall be in St. Paul, but you shall hold hearings at any other place within the state, so the taxpayers may appear before the court with as little inconvenience and expense to the taxpayers as is practicable. On that $500 mileage, how many trips out of the metropolitan area does that represent?
It can vary from year to year. Last year, for example, most are within the metro area, the seven counties. I would say about five or six, maybe one or two, give or take, were beyond that area, where they were outstate, completely outstate, Fargo, Duluth, south of Rochester.
Do you charge a standard federally set mileage?
We file for the reimbursement that is under the guidelines of what's produced by the state. The state will say what the mileage reimbursement is, and then that's what the judges file for.
What is that amount?
50 cents a mile.
Okay. So how many trips would $500 take you out state?
Again, it varies. We've been able to do about maybe 3 to 5 trips.
Switching to another line item on your budget information, you list rent at $127,838 for fiscal year 2011. What floor space or what space are you renting for that amount of money?
We rent the space that houses the six employees, which also includes a small area for the law clerks to come in and work, small area, a small library, a conference room, and then and when I say small, it is very small. Where the copier is can hold 2-3 people, and then also our courtroom, which is not connected. It's around the corner from our offices. It's right around the corner. Those are the two primary spaces that are covered. And then there's what Office of Administration has informed us, that there's this common space that from the elevator, the hallways, the bathrooms, public bathrooms, that we are also charged with, along with all the other tenants in the building, that's the way they reconfigured and recalculated their rent charge.
What building are you renting that space?
The Judicial Center.
So you're renting a courtroom space in the Judicial Center, is that
yes.
correct? The statute that I read from 271.04 also goes on to say the tax court shall be allowed to use the district courtroom in all of the counties. If you're allowed to use an existing district courtroom in Ramsey County, why are you renting your own courtroom in the Judicial Center?
I think that the statute speaks to the courtrooms that we're allowed to use when we leave Ramsey County, when we go to Hennepin County, when we go to outstate. That's where we hold our hearings, is in their courtrooms, in their state courthouses throughout the 87 counties. There is a courtroom in Ramsey County, which would be in downtown St. Paul. I know that that's fully utilized by the judges that work and function there. Most of our cases are not in Ramsey County. We have some in Ramsey County. We have a lot in Hennepin County, and then we have some in outstate Minnesota as well.
Well, let me rephrase the question then based on that answer. If most of your cases are not held in Ramsey County, why are you renting a courtroom space in Ramsey County when the statute says you can use the district courtroom in all of the counties?
Okay.
It looks to me like an unnecessary rental expenditure.
I don't mean to give the impression that we don't hold a lot of cases in Ramsey County. We do. Our commissioner cases, which are apart from our property tax appeal cases, are all held I would say most of them are held in St. Paul. Those are not cases that have to do with property tax appeals, where there's a property and then it goes according to what venue it is. When it has to do with commissioner cases, which are income and sales and use tax and so forth, those are not property driven, so those are all held in St. Paul. The way the court is constructed, the way the space is constructed, that is a space that is provided in unison. I think that the savings would be marginal. It's a courtroom that's designated for the tax court at this point. The tax court uses that court primarily. When it's not in use by the tax court, other judges, other agencies use it. There are many times when we're double booked or triple booked with our own cases, and we use the other courtrooms that are available in the Judicial Center as well. So I don't know if that fully answers your question, but that's describing the use of it.
I don't want to micro question this particular line item, but I'm probably going to, because it looks like an unnecessary expenditure. If the statute says you have a courtroom available in all of the counties, I guess I don't understand why you're renting year-round court space in a building that is not in the district court. What total floor space square footage floor space square footage area are you renting, and what percent of that total is the courtroom?
The total square footage that we're renting is 6,519 square feet.
19. What portion of that is the courtroom?
You know, the courtroom is a very, very small courtroom. I can get you what that square footage is exactly.
Please supply that, Judge. Also, what is your monthly rental on that 6,519 square feet?
For 2011, it's $127,838.
For the year?
For the year. But I will get a breakdown of what the courtroom square footage is.
Okay, please do. On a parallel issue relative to the information supplied to committee thus far, it would appear that you took it upon yourself to close your operations for several weeks recently to hold your spending within the appropriation. I heard you testify that that was 2 weeks. Is that the correct number
yes.
of weeks? During those 2 weeks that you were, quote, closed for operations, unquote, were there any funds expended during that 2 weeks for either rent or salaries, even though you weren't working?
The entire court took unpaid leave. Rent was still expended. All the other expenses were still expended. Everything else except for the salary that was unpaid.
Were there any cases, taxpayer cases, that were not heard during that shutdown?
Yes.
How many?
Approximately 50.
Were they ultimately heard?
They have been ultimately heard. They were delayed.
Do you or any other tax court employees use state-owned vehicles in your travel?
No.
So that $500 allotment is for privately owned vehicles at a 50% mileage reimbursement rate, is that correct?
Yes. There was a system of that the state provided previously, years ago, and they did provide vehicles, and we used the vehicles when they were provided. That system has since gone, has ceased to continue.
Judge, do you handle any cases that are not required by statute? Any functions or any cases or any functions that are not required by statute?
No, sir.
If you were to advise this committee on how you would find a 15% reduction in your baseline budget, what would you look at and how would that affect services that you render?
The only line item that we could look at would be salaries, which again would force us to close the court. And Mr. Chair, for clarification, are you asking from what's been
I guess
a portion or what the current base of 790?
Restate your question to me.
Okay. I was asking whether you were asking whether that 15% is from what the governor's proposal is of 835 or the 790. Without the governor's
Judge,
appropriation
from the 790.
Okay.
From your current base,
the 790 already would force us to close down. An additional 15% cut would just mean additional shutdown time.
When that shutdown occurred for 2 weeks, did your judges forego their pay?
Yes.
Did your staff forego pay?
Yes.
So all judges and all FTEs gave up 2 weeks of pay?
Yes.
But the rent continued?
Yes.
Other expenses continued?
Yes.
What other expenses?
Rent. Everything else, the use of the copiers, the computers, internet access, the phone system, our supplies. Everything else continued.
One last question, and then we'll go to the rest of the committee. Again, looking at 271.04 Minnesota statutes, it says the tax court shall, quote, be allowed to use the district court room in all of the counties, unquote. Did I hear you say that it's your belief that means all counties but Ramsey?
No, I think it would include Rams.
Then what's the reason you're not using the Ramsey County District courtroom and instead renting unnecessary courtroom space?
I think when was not involved when the initial contract was promulgated with the state, but most courts are next to their courtrooms, whether it's district court, court of appeals, Supreme Court. They have their chambers and they have their courts adjacent to their courtrooms. And I think when if you look at the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, which also is housed in our building, they have the same structure where they have their offices and they have a courtroom there as well, as does the Supreme Court Court of Appeals. I think that's just the practice that's employed.
Okay, we'll go to other questioners. Representatives Johnson and Chemaski. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge, I think you answered most of the questions during the course of Chair Smith's questioning, but just a comment on that. The 38,000 deficiency that stands out to me, it's just a sign of a lack of funding of our judiciary as a whole, and I think it reflects poorly on the state of Minnesota that we have to close the doors of what appears to be a very important function of the state for that two-week period. So, again, this is what stands out to me when I look at this book, is that we have to actually close an important part of our state for 2 weeks because we don't have enough money to pay for the services that are needed. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Chemaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judge Perez, talking about that two-week shutdown, I noticed in the report here you have 5.5 FTEs on staff. Would it be possible to do that two-week uncompensated leave on a rotating basis and continue to operate the office rather than have all the staff absent for 2 weeks?
We looked at every possible combination, and we were trying to find something that was as least disruptive to the court and also least disruptive to the employees. Many of the employees, this is their one job in their household. They don't have two households working, so mindful of all of that, we looked at a number of combinations. We shut down for, I think, of a period of 6 straight days. The other days we did try to take in different times. But at the same time, it's less efficient. If we say we're going to bring the staff in and one or two judges are not going to be there, that limits what we can do. And conversely, if we say, well, we're going to have a couple of the judges there and not the staff there, that limits what the court can do. So even if we stagger it, we're less than efficient in doing that. And so one of the proposals that, and again, it wasn't the best one. There is no best case scenario. But if we all just shut down, that it would almost be the least inefficient way to do it, even though it created a short-term backlog and a short-term delay in our cases and in our calls and our filings. But to do it in other ways, we're still inefficient because we'd be missing different parts of, because we're so small. I know that other courts, the way they've absorbed some of the cuts is that they can shut down for an afternoon on Fridays or an afternoon on Wednesdays. Because we're so small, it didn't lend itself to that kind of and have the kind of impact. Again, the cuts, because our budget is so small, those cuts are so severe, and so the number of days quickly adds up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. I'm going to, Chairman wants to ask a couple more questions, Your Honor, and looking at your case filings, the cost to file a case before you is what? per case?
Regular division, which is our, the majority of our cases, is $350. We have small claim cases, which is $150.
So for $350, I can file a case and get heard before you to talk about why my property taxes are too high.
Yes.
And of the cases you get, 40% are residential.
Yes.
And that's mom and pop living down the street wanting to come and get their property taxes lowered.
Yes.
On average, of those residential cases, how many hours does each case take on average?
I think that would be divided into cases that settle versus the ones that go to trial.
Let's say trial.
If it's a mom and pop case, that probably takes about a day, maybe 2 days to try. So if we're looking at 8 hours a day, 16 hours plus preparation, plus a couple of pretrial motions.
Your Honor, I want to be clear. I'm talking about in-court time use of the courtroom.
16 hours.
2 days.
2 days.
What about the commercial cases, which consume 60% of your courtroom time? What's the average number of hours a commercial case takes?
Those average 1 to 2 weeks.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you say is that mom and pop residential case costs $350, and they wind up on average in 2 days, and 60% of your time is consumed by companies like Walmart. I probably shouldn't mention names, but let's just say wealthy corporations consuming 60% of your time for the same $350 filing fee and taking 2 weeks instead of 2 days on average. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's correct. I will add one caveat to that is that in tax court you can petition each year individually. So many times, unlike the mom and pop, what the corporations do is they'll tag on subsequent years. So when we hear a case, it'll be maybe 3 years, sometimes 4 years at a time. They'll challenge not just the 1 year, but they'll challenge 2 or 3 years out.
Okay, what I'd like you to do is supply me and this committee with some information. But before I tell you what that information is, I want to ask your personal opinion, not your legal opinion. Do you think it strikes me that it's not quite fair to let a corporation get away consuming 2 weeks for the same filing fee an ordinary citizen gets 2 days? So would you please provide us with a breakdown of your per day cost to hold your court open? That would include your salary, benefits, rental for a day, the clerk, whoever is involved in opening, running, and closing that courtroom on a per diem basis. And I'd like that by the first part of the week.
Okay. I will provide that, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions from the committee? I don't see any. Judge, thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you, committee members.
Committee, we have on our schedule House File 229, Representative Downey. This bill was heard previously. It was laid over by the chair. I've already informed Representative Downey I'm not going to bring this bill back today. There was some discussion with me prior to convening our hearing by a member, I was going to say to my left, but I'll just say one of the DFL members suggested that it may need a little more work. In deference to the clock, to the author who is not here, and in an effort to give a little more time to the potential of offering amendments, I'm going to leave the bill where it is. We're not going to take it up today, but we will take it up at our next hearing. Seeing no further business to come before this committee, the meeting is adjourned.